702.
Weird and wonderful.
Professor Jane Rickson is my guest, Professor of Soil Erosion and Conservation at Cranfield University in the UK. Dr. Rickson, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really, really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, my absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, soil erosion is something that many of us have heard about at one point or the other, and you know, we know that it's something that happens as a result perhaps of wind or water or whatever natural phenomenon. We also know that human beings can be a big reason why we see a lot of soil erosion, and there's many other reasons. But why is soil erosion such an important subject for us to be talking about globally at the moment?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, soil erosion is a natural process, actually, and it doesn't have much impact if it's balanced by the rate of soil formation. So you lose some soil, but you gain some soil. The problem is when we mismanage land through poor agricultural practices or through mining activities, or when we mismanage land, then that rate of erosion exceeds the soil formation rate. So we get a net loss of soil. And as you say, that could be because of rainfall, it could be because of surface overland flow, it could be because of wind erosion. And the consequences of that, we're losing a really, really precious natural resource that does all sorts of things for us. You know, as a society, it delivers our food, our fiber, our fodder, even our biofuel, for example. And we get so many services from soil, which when it erodes, when it washes away, we lose those services. But then you have to, and that's what we call on-site impacts of erosion. Where, you know, where the erosion actually takes place. But actually, we've done some research, and the off-site impacts of where all of that soil ends up can be just as damaging, because it affects things like water quality, sedimentation of reservoirs, you know, so it has on-site and off-site impacts. And, you know, with climate change, we're seeing that these impacts are increasing both over space and time. So, it is a huge problem. I mean, I would say that I'm a professor of soil erosion, so I would say it's a problem, but we are seeing it accelerating because of these climate change effects.
You've already spoken about why soil is important to us, the benefits we get from it, you know, for food and all of those kinds of things. But what about the fact that we as human beings are building, right? We are replacing natural soil with buildings, with concrete. We remove the vegetation that is supposed to be stopping the movement of the soil. Where does that soil go, right? Is it retrievable? But most importantly, to what extent is the purpose of soil on this planet being repurposed by the activities of man, like building and so forth?
So there's lots of points there. I mean, soil is, as I say, a precious, almost irreplaceable natural resource. And as you say, it delivers what we call lots of different ecosystems, goods and services that you and I and all your listeners will really, really benefit from. You know, if you think about what you have for your breakfast this morning, 94% of our food comes from soil. So if we mismanage soil in the way that you're describing, then it becomes what we call degraded. We have soil degradation or land degradation. And soil erosion is just one of those processes. We have other things that can damage the soil, things like contamination, things like compaction, things like loss of biodiversity. And really, really important is loss of soil organic carbon. Soil is a brilliant store of carbon. Basically, it takes carbon by the vegetation that grows on soil. That vegetation takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And as we all know, carbon dioxide is associated with global warming and climate change and so on. But soil is a brilliant store. It can hold on to this carbon. It takes the carbon down through the soil, through the plant roots, and stores that carbon in the soil, where it is then is very safe and it can be what we call sequestered. But again, if I come along and I mismanage my land, I take the vegetation away, as you say, or I disturb the soil, I create very steep slopes, for example, in railway and road cuttings and embankments, then I'm going to lose that soil and I'm going to lose all of that precious carbon within the soil. And as I say, that is transported off-site, where that place where the erosion actually occurs, and it ends up in our rivers and our streams and our lakes and our reservoirs, and ultimately it goes out to our oceans. And you can imagine that, you know, if you've got this sediment, if you've got this soil, all these particles of sands and clays and silts, if they're all being washed into our watercourses, then that really affects the quality of the water. And that in turn affects all the biodiversity, all the animals, the vegetation that is grown in or is growing in clean water resources. So as I say, this is a big problem that we have with soil erosion. It's not just where it occurs, you know, where we lose this soil and we see big channels called gullies or rills, washing farmland particularly away, but it's where that soil ends up. And, you know, the impact of that can be even greater than where we've lost the soil. And to answer your question, yeah, can we replace it? Well, I would say no, we can't, because soil has taken thousands, maybe millions of years to form. You know, you sort of get just a few centimetres in 1,000 years by the time the geology breaks down and the organic matter is mixed. So making soil is a really, really difficult and long-term job. But we can degrade that soil overnight. And replacing the soil that's been washed away is really, really difficult if we want to replace it with healthy, natural, functioning soil.
The Americans call it dirt.
Oh, don't start me on dirt. My lifelong ambition is to try and avoid the negative connotations of soil. If you think of the word soil, it has a lot of negative connotations. As you say, dirt, muck, you know, it is muddy. It's got really bad connotations, and yet it is so important. There's a wonderful quote, absolutely lovely quote, from American scientists that say this, and I quote, "This thin layer of soil represents the difference between survival and extinction for most terrestrial life." So who knew? Soil is a matter of life and death. You know, if we degrade our soils, if we erode our soils, we won't have anything to eat. We won't have any sponge that holds floodwaters. We won't have carbon storage within the soil. So it really is so important. And as you say, the word soil has got such negative, soiled, you know, is dirty. Yep. It's dirt. It's mud. It's muck. And yet, interestingly, and again, don't want to get onto semantics here because I'm a scientist rather than an artist. But if you then think of the word earth, which soil is also associated with, you know, in here where I am in England at the moment, we call soil earth. It's to say, and earth is a much more positive vibe, you know, in terms of Mother Earth, you know, planet Earth, and it's got a much more natural and positive view. Just a word, just a difference in one word. One is soil, negative, soiled, mud, dirt, and the other one is earth, and it's Mother Earth, and it's much more positive image. So it is really interesting, the semantics of, yep, the word soil itself. Yeah,
just had a conversation about finances, and we've just discovered how important words are. You know, we talk about changing a mindset versus shifting a mindset, and how all of those issues are so important. And so I'm a communicator, I'm a broadcaster, so words really, really matter for me in order for us to drive certain ideas home. About, is soil alive, Doctor?
Well, yes, and interesting, you were saying about, you know, nudging behaviours and attitudes. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm coming round to answer your question. As you can see, I sort of whittle on and sort of go right round the houses in answering your question. But again, a passion of mine is that soil science is, forgive me, but often, maybe not so much nowadays, but certainly in the past, soil science was actually taught in a very boring way, you know, that soil is inert. It's this mud, it's this dirt, it's this brown stuff. And soil science has often been taught in a very dry, frankly, boring way. But when you look at soils, they are alive, as your question, you know, it is extraordinary. The fungi, the bacteria, the nematodes, the earthworms, all the different flora and fauna that we find in the soil. And soil biology is, you know, is really, as a colleague of mine, Professor Carl Ritz, said, soil biology is the engine of the earth. If we didn't have that fungi, that bacteria, those microscopic microbial communities in the soil, if we didn't have those, we wouldn't have nutrients released to our crops, you know, which then feed us and give us the strength and health and so on. And so soil is really alive. And as I say, it tends not to be seen because you can't see these microbial communities. You can't see the fungi. You can't see the bacteria. You know, people just think it's an inert material like concrete or aggregates or whatever, but actually it is teeming with life. There's a wonderful statistic that says there's more microbial organisms in a teaspoon of soil than there is population in China. And what an incredible statistic. And of course you can't see them because they're microscopic. You can't see them unless you have a really super strong microscope. But that is incredible. A healthy soil, you know, healthy soil with lots of organic matter, lots of organic carbon within that soil has more microorganisms than there are population in China. And that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Give me a call.
As I say, these sorry, go on.
Sorry, I'm wanting to invite our listeners to be part of this conversation. And I'm asking the question, what is your relationship to soil? Is it one of you and dirt? Or is it one of you? Is it one of you and this thin layer of life that makes terrestrial life possible? Give me a call. I'd like to hear your thoughts. And what is soil called in your indigenous language? Because it's important, I think, that the conversation that Professor Rickson and I have just had about the semantics of the matter. What does your language call this thing? Because that, for me, will reveal the attitude that we have towards it. Yeah? Teaspoon of soil has got more life teeming in it than the population of China. Give me a call. I'd like to hear from you on 011-883-0702. The Weird and the Wonderful with Professor Jane Rickson, Professor of Soil Erosion and Conservation at Cranfield University in the UK. I'm thinking now of the Great Deserts, Dr. Rickson, and the big dunes. We have great deserts here in South Africa, but, you know, the Kalahari Desert, the Karoo. We have the Sahara Desert on the African continent, many others on other continents, right? Is it possible to somehow repurpose the sand dunes into functional soils?
You know, there are lots of projects that have tried to do this, and it's not really my area of expertise, but, you know, if we go back to sort of real first basics, the deserts are there for a reason. You know, deserts, again, are natural phenomena because of the climate of that area. And, you know, because you have very arid conditions, you know, very low rainfall, incredibly low rainfall, and very hot temperatures, although you can have cold deserts as well. But the critical thing is low rainfall. And I think your question is, can we compensate for that, the fact that naturally there is low rainfall in those desert areas? And there have been lots of projects that have tried to green the desert, and, as I say, compensate for the natural phenomena of this very low rainfall. And, you know, you can bring in irrigation, you can bring in water, you can bring in nutrients, you can bring in all the critical components of making land productive. But you have to think about whether that's sustainable in the long term and whether these systems will actually self-regenerate. You know, we're thinking of, you know, importing water. The water has to come from somewhere if you're trying to compensate for the fact that you've got naturally low rainfall. And that water has to come from somewhere. And we have to ask our question, is that depleting water resources somewhere else? You know, is it economical to actually bring that water from elsewhere? And as I say, just water and sand isn't going to be very productive in terms of growing crops. So you need to bring in nutrients, and then you need to think about where those fertilizers are coming from. So I think we need to be factual in that a number of deserts are natural features, and just we cannot reverse that natural process. However, where deserts occur because we as a human race have mismanaged the land, then I think there's more cause for optimism, in the sense that those deserts have been man-made or human-made, I should say. And therefore, I'm an optimist to say, well, if we've damaged that land and caused desertification, then surely we can then reverse that. And there's a lot of discussion at the moment about regeneration, regenerative practices that kind of build back better, that you may have damaged soil, you might have damaged the environment, but you can actually build back better using technologies and sustainable agriculture practices that might bring that soil back. But I think we need to be realistic that in some places, deserts are natural features because of the aridity of that area. And trying to say, well, we can green the deserts, you know, and projects have come to nothing, really, that have ignored the fact that these are natural phenomena. And, you know, as a race, and you know, humankind, are we able to reverse what is a natural phenomena? And I would be cautious about that.
I'm going to ask what maybe is going to sound like a morbid question, and then I'm going to take some calls as they come in on 011-883-0702. The regeneration of soil, I imagine, requires some entry of organic material. And that would either regenerate or at least enhance the quality of the soil, because there's all sorts of organic material that comes in there. There are trees that are dying all the time. Animals that are dying all the time. Human beings are dying all the time. Is there some sort of model, some approach to trying to regain soil that uses that unfortunate resource?
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right in saying that the best way to regenerate soil, often the problem with soils, I mean, assuming that they haven't been eroded and lost completely, that, you know, degradation of soil is because often they're losing their organic matter in particular. There's other things too as well, like their structure and their nutrient status, and their biology. We've talked about the biology and how important that is. But at the end of the day, it is a lot of it is about organic matter content and trying to maximize that. So we work with farmers here in the UK, and indeed we work, you know, throughout the world, I'm delighted to say. And you mentioned Morocco. I've just come back from Morocco, where we're working with farmers there and looking at how we can work within existing farming systems to incorporate more organic matter into the soil. Now I know a lot of farmers need all of the plant material that they've produced. You know, they harvest their crops, and it's not just the ears of corn, for example, that they use, but they use the stems, they use all of that organic matter for things like feed for cattle, thatching, you know, sort of bedding for cattle and so on. So farmers are often tempted to take all of the plant material, organic matter, off the fields because it's used for other reasons. But if we can encourage farmers somehow to grow either cover crops, you know, in between the main cash crops, or indeed companion crops alongside the cash crop, just so that we can try and tweak that organic matter and return it to the soil, because that is, again, the lifeblood of soil in terms of feeding those organisms that I mentioned before, which in turn help nutrient supply, which in turn help the stability of soils and so on and so forth. So we, as I say, we are working with farmers to try and increase their production so that they've got more organic matter that can be replaced, you know, back into the soil. And I always think it's good to look at natural systems. And if you look at forests and natural conditions, you know, that's exactly what the cycle of life is. You know, you have a tree, it grows, it dies, it decays, and all of that organic matter and all of that organic carbon, it's taken out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis, is then returned back to the soil, where then new trees, new vegetation can grow within that replenished soil. And I always think that farming systems, you know, whenever we have man-made systems, we should try and replicate nature as much as we possibly can, you know, appreciating that we need to increase food production on this very limited natural resource, given, you know, world population and increasing population. How are we going to feed everybody when we've still got a very finite resource of this soil? And that's one of the big global challenges, I think, that we face right now.
Let's take some calls. Let's take some calls. 011-883-0702. Selma is in Roodepoort. Hi, Selma.
Hi, yes, Aubrey. I am one of those people that other people get to frown on because I love the wild garden.
Mm.
I always replenish the soil with compost and stuff, and I let my trees grow big, and then they grow fruit, or they just have beautiful places for the birds to make their nests in, and then they, like the mulberry is huge, and there's so many mulberries on it that the birds have a feast.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I have flowers that attract, flowery plants that attract all the bees, which are pollinators. And the leaves that fall in the flower beds, or where the trees are, I don't keep on taking them away all the time, like people tend to do, because of God's garden looks smart. I leave them there to decay. And many years later, when you dig around and you get this beautiful loam, and you can see it's all the decayed plants that start sort of compacting. And you won't be surprised about the worms and stuff that crawl around in there. And the hardy does love picking out the worms, earthworms and so on. So it feeds them. And the grey lilies love the mulberries and so on and so on. So in India, you have this total ecosystem of various little things that get fed from other things, but it all starts with the soil that creates the trees. And because the trees give us all this oxygen, you get lichen growing on the stems and so on. And this means that we are healthier because we get more oxygen. And then, like people say, we once had some building work going on that destroyed the part of my lawn. And I then went and got some suitable grass seeds and again put on a whole load of fertilizer and raked everything over, kept it on watering it. And my neighbor once said to me, you know, yesterday there was nothing. Now you've got a lawn. How do you do it? I said, well, just by looking after the soil, by sowing things, watering it, it's just a natural process. You've just got to make sure you follow the process. And she couldn't believe this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is to me, the quality of the soil and not getting rid of your leaves and stuff just because it should look neat.
Yeah.
That, to me, is destroying your ecosystem.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The manicured gardens and all of those kinds of things, Selma. So you're saying let it all hang out, huh?
Oh, yes. Some people love these wild gardens because you've got such a diversity of critters and things.
I hear you.
Cats that absolutely love all the
absolutely.
They can't get enough.
Absolutely. Selma is in Roodepoort. Much appreciated. I suppose the models for living with the natural world need to be repurposed, reconfigured in our minds, Prof, because very often those models are about us. They're very centricized on the human situation of what we want out of it. Perhaps the conservation aspect of this needs a totally different paradigm of less manicured gardens and what we would call beautiful in the human sense. And I imagine that that would go very, very, very strongly into what Selma is talking about in the replenishment of soil.
Yeah, yes, very much so. And I mean, I think the classic example is in the US, you know, the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, which I hope your listeners have are familiar with. But this is where basically European settlers moved over to the States, to North America, and introduced sort of European farming practices that were really, really not suitable for that particular landscape and that soil and that land. And it worked for a few years, but then after a while, the yields went down. The vegetation was very poor. It was very sort of, there was hardly any vegetation cover. So that when the rains came and when the winds came, soil erosion was huge. And in fact, out of that sort of mismanagement of land and ignoring nature, ignoring, well, what are the soil types here? You know, what is the rainfall here? What is the wind speed here? What are the slopes, you know, that I can cultivate without causing erosion? By ignoring that, those early settlers weren't in tune with nature. And as I say, we got the US Dust Bowl as a result. But some good came out of that. I mean, we learned the lessons from that. I mean, I wasn't around then. I'm old, but I'm not that old. During the 1930s, you know, it developed the United States Department of Agriculture and the Soil Conservation Service, which is, you know, one of the best in the world. And from that, we learned so many lessons the hard way, sure, but we did learn lessons that you have to be respectful of nature. You have to go within your means, not go beyond your means. And Selma was giving brilliant examples there of how she's replicating nature in her own garden, you know, by letting the trees grow and letting the vegetation die down and the biodiversity and the bees, butterflies and bees and earthworms. So, you know, we do need to work with nature. The challenge here, however, is can we produce enough produce, you know, food and fiber and fodder by following those natural ways? And this is the huge challenge that, you know, if you look at organic systems, for example, there is concern where you're just using organic systems, whether the yields can be comparable with more intensive agriculture. And I'm sure there are farmers on the call tonight that, you know, have intensive, or may have organic farms, but they may also have intensive farms. If we want our food to be economically cheap, frankly, you know, affordable, then we have to have some of these large-scale farming practices that, you know, deliver cheap, relatively cheap food. And the problem is some of these more natural, regenerative practices have lower yields, so therefore we need more land to produce enough food. And this is the great dilemma we have as natural resource scientists and helping policymakers. What do you do? Do you intensify production to feed everyone, or do you extensify production, in which case you take more land out for agriculture? And I bet this is the problem in South Africa. It's the same in UK. I think it's worldwide, this dilemma we have.
Leroy is in Tembisa. Hi, Leroy.
Hi,
yeah, go ahead, sir.
A few questions for the professor there. I want to ask you, the amount of soil that you have on the land, does that affect the global warming? Because I think if you have more soil, then the heat can be absorbed into the soil. And the other question is, if you have run out of soil, if it has been eroded, can we replace the soil? Maybe put it from the desert and
Leroy, I'm going to stop you because the sound is not of great quality, but let me quickly rephrase what Leroy is asking, Professor. He's asking questions around the phenomenon of global warming. As to what extent does soil erosion contribute to global warming? But he's asking this similar question to what I've asked about the regeneration of perhaps not soil, just soil, but even the deserts, whether something like that. You've already touched on that, but that's the question. Whether can we revitalize some of the soils that are understood to be to not have the life that can produce vegetation and therefore replenish life, as it were.
702.
Weird and wonderful.
So, Gasesotho, in the Sesotho language, the name for soil is Mobu. And I suppose the connotation there, Professor Rickson, is that it is not considered, it's not associated with the idea of dirt, you know. The Sesotho word for soil is really about it being associated with a giver of life. So isn't it interesting that in some of the indigenous languages down here in South Africa, the name for soil is not perhaps is not negative in its connotation, and perhaps that's where we also perhaps need to start to say, you know, what do we call this thing, and what we call it is reflective of the attitude we have to it, towards it.
Yes, it'd be hard to change. I think, you know, people, it's hard. I wouldn't want to change the word. I'd just like to nudge attitudes that they really, you know, people start to really appreciate how important soil is. You know, I think there's a great disconnect. I think because we have more urban life, you know, more people, in the UK in particular, more people live in towns and cities than they do in the rural areas. And so therefore people are disconnected with soil. And for example, you know, where their food comes from. And, you know, you hear stories of kids going into supermarkets and they don't know where potatoes come from and things like that. Oh, they come from the supermarket.
They come from the earth, you know. Yeah.
So I wonder whether it's a sort of social thing in that we are more disconnected to earth and soil. But as I say, I'm on a one woman mission to try and you know, make people appreciate soil and the name soil and change attitudes that it is this wonderful thing. And, you know, even if it's by saying things like, you know, did you watch your football team at the weekend? Well, what were they playing on? Of course, there's always somebody who says AstroTurf, but, you know, most football games, for example, I'm a great cricket fan, you know, I love cricket.
Yeah.
You know, cricket is played on soil, yes, on grass, but the way the pitch plays, the way the bowlers can, you know, cause the ball to spin, all of this stuff depends on the way the soil behaves. And yes, it's the vegetation, the grass that's grown on that soil. So, you know, even if people feel disconnected with their food production, there's so many other things that we get from soil. And, you know, and another area that I'm not usually allowed to talk about in my day job, because I'm meant to be a soil scientist, but, you know, there's a lot of soil involved in art and culture, you know, things like paintings and sculptures and, you know, art installations, you know, rely on soil or earth. And, you know, it's just what I find that aspect of soil is really often overlooked. People don't think of it in terms of how it affects our culture. And yet it is really, really important and underpins a lot of our culture as well as the science behind soil. So
I want to take a quick call from James in Rudaport, but I do want to remind you of the question asked earlier. About how can, to what extent soil erosion affects the phenomenon of global warming, and is it possible to regain soil lost through whatever processes that you've already touched on. James is in Roodepoort. Hi, James.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I need a bit of confirmation on a few things here, just so that I know I understand it correctly. I know that when you excavate, build on a new piece of land, like you're going to put up a school there or a shopping center or whatever, then the yellow machines come in and they take off about the top meter, I think, of the soil, and they put it all in one corner of the land in a heap, because that is the living soil that you can actually plant something into. The soil deeper than that is regarded as dead soil. Then when they finish with the whole construction, they will take that heap and they will distribute it evenly across the land that is left over, and then you can plant grass and whatever else there that you want. Now, that principle is true. And I live higher up on the hill than you do. And I am a cattle farmer, but I'm ignorant and I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm overgrazing my land. And I don't have enough grass on my land to keep the sand there when the rain comes. And my sand is going to wash down over your land, who are lower down than me, and then it's going to end up in the river at the bottom. But I'm never going to replenish that land ever again, because I'm on the hill. Where's it going to come from? Am I correct in saying that the only source of new sand is the erosion of rock?
Very good question, James. Prof?
So I am sure you're not ignorant at all, James. I'm sure you're very learned, and farmers know more than they're credited for. So the answer to your question is, or my attempt to answer your question, is that the soil that you're talking about, you call it sand, that is going to be healthy soil is made up of lots of different components. Part of that is mineral, so sands and silts and clays. That comes from the geology, as you say, that the weathering of the geology at depth breaks down, those rocks break down through weathering processes, and that gives you, if you like, the foundation of soil. But soil as that itself, the mineral component, would just be broken down geology. That's not soil. Soil also requires some of this organic matter, some of this material that gives it its life, gives its nutrient cycling, is able to hold on to water. So hopefully you don't generate runoff that causes all of your soil, your sand, as you call it, washing down to the lower ground. So it is very, very important that not only do you have that geology breaking down, by the way, that's a really long-term process that doesn't happen overnight, but then you build up, as well as that geology, that mineral, that sand, the silt and the clay that you've got from the geology, you build up that organic matter. That will come from the roots of your grasses. That will come from the roots of your trees, your bushes that you're hopefully able to grow on your land as well. And of course, there's a horrible negative feedback here, because when you lose soil, then you're no longer able to grow vegetation as well, because you're just losing that soil depth, which holds on to the nutrients and the water that that vegetation needs. So it's really, really important, and it's a very long-term process that you try and build up some of that organic matter through the vegetation, trying to wean more vegetation, more root growth, more root mass that then will add to the mineral material that you have in your soils, so that you can build up this resilience against things like the rainfall events that are washing your soils away.
Talk to
and
me.
Yeah. It is really difficult. I have to say, it is really, really difficult. I've worked some years ago, I worked in Eswatini saw some of these issues in terms of high stocking density of on rangeland, how the cattle then destroy the vegetation. They eat the vegetation, which exposes the soil to the atmosphere, to the rainfall, to the wind, which causes erosion, which then loses that soil. So it's very difficult to grow more vegetation. So I do appreciate this is a really tough challenge, but the secret, or not secret really, but I mean, it's about getting that organic matter back. so that you can get that nutrient cycle, you can hold on to the water during the wet season so that you hopefully can grow more vegetation. And then it's a virtuous circle rather than a negative spiral into soil degradation.
What about global warming and soil degradation?
Yeah, so coming back to Leroy's point, actually, can I just mention one more thing that James mentioned, and I'll come on to Leroy's point. So, James, you mentioned about, you know, urban construction, the protocol for constructing, that you're quite right that constructors take that topsoil, that 1 meter, 60 centimeters, 1 meter, they take that topsoil and they put it in a spoil heap. They then do all the land forming with the subsoil. You called it dead soil. Even in the subsoil, we've still got some life in there, actually. It's not as fertile. It's not as alive as the topsoil. But subsoil is still not dead. It's not inert, but it's not as good as the topsoil. Now, you said that quite rightly that they then cart that topsoil and they store it in spoil heaps. Then when the land forming is done, they bring that topsoil back and they landscape the site. The big problem with that, you're quite right, you've got that down to a T. The problem with that is that those spoil heaps, if you bury that topsoil to within sort of a meter, 2 meters, then you start to get rid of the oxygen. That really fertile soil starts to lose oxygen because it's just so deep. It can't get the atmospheric gases into that spoil heap. And we see that actually the soil biology is affected by that. And you may actually kill off the soil biology, the microbes, the earthworms and so on you had in the topsoil when it was only a meter deep. If that spoil heap then becomes 2 meters, 3 meters deep, then you get these what we call anaerobic conditions where you don't have the oxygen there. And your lifeblood of that soil then is destroyed. And I've seen this. I've worked with mining companies, and we've seen this huge earth moving to create these spoil heaps, and that can be a problem. So you know, it sounds sensible, but there are problems. Sorry. Now coming back to Leroy's point. So soil erosion does have a direct connection with global warming. First of all, when you have soil erosion, when soil is transported away, is removed from where it belongs, it's detached and then it's transported away, that exposes the soil organic matter within the soil. So often with erosion, what happens first is that the vegetation is removed and then the topsoil is removed, and that then exposes all of this organic matter that we've talked about. And that organic carbon is then exposed to the oxygen in the atmosphere. And if we have carbon and oxygen mixed together, we have CO2, carbon dioxide, which is the greenhouse gas, which then escapes into the atmosphere. We know that that carbon dioxide heats up more readily than oxygen or other atmospheric gases. And as a result, we get higher atmospheric temperatures, which are associated with global warming, which in turn is associated with climate change. So there is a direct link between soil erosion, exposing the carbon that's being stored or sequestered in the soil. It's being exposed to the atmosphere and it's then emitted in the atmosphere.
Any documents, literature that you can point us to, and perhaps your contact details if anybody wants to continue this conversation with you outside of this platform, what do you have to offer in that sense?
Oh, I'd be delighted. So, I mean, I can give my email address if that's useful.
Sure,
J.Rickson, RICKSON, at Cranfield, CRANFIELD.ac.uk. That's my email address. Please feel free to contact me. There's so much literature out there. I think I'm probably, if people want to get in contact with me, I can then advise as to what books or articles or documents they can refer to. But a lot out there.
Professor Jane Rickson, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed the conversation on soil. And I'm sure we'll have a conversation again sometime soon. Thank you so much for joining us.